Okay, everyone, we'll start in 3 more minutes.
Thank you.
All right, I think everyone is here already, so let's just start the session. So good evening, everyone. Namo Buddhaya. Welcome to the second day of our Katina event series, I'm Perfect, Accepting Your Imperfect Self. I'm Quincy from City Zen, and I'll be your host for tonight. So thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for spending some time today to teach us how to accept all our imperfections and how to practice self-love. We'd also like to thank the Buddhist Society of Victoria's tremendous support and both collaborating entities, City Zen and Buddhist Union, for all our hard work to make this event happen. Last but not least, thank you to all of you viewers for tuning in to our Dharma Talk today, both via Zoom and YouTube. City Zen, we all hope that you will find today's session very beneficial, and we hope that you can pass on the Dharma to your friends and family. Next, let us pay our respects to the First Nations people. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the various lands on which we work today, and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people participating in this webinar. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize and celebrate the diversity of Aboriginal peoples and their ongoing cultures and connections to the lands and waters which we reside upon. Okay. So now we would like to introduce the Buddhist youth communities hosting this event. First, I'm going to introduce you about City Zen. So we are the Buddhist Society of Victoria's Young Adults Group. Our vision is to bring Buddhist wisdom, friendship, and peace to young adults. Our group hosts fortnightly Dharma discussions and other activities, such as game nights, panel webinars, and many more. So if you're interested in getting to know us better, do look up our Facebook and Instagram page. Also to our website, go to bsv.net.au/citizen. Now I'd like to invite my friend Jaislyn. She's gonna explain a lot more about Buddhist Union.
Thanks, Quincy, for the great introduction. Hi everyone, thank you all so much for being here with us today. My name is Jaislyn from Buddhist Union Melbourne. First of all, I would like to use this opportunity to thank our speaker Ajahn Brahm. We're very humbled and honored to have you here today. To our event partner, City Zen and Buddhist Society of Victoria, thank you for your hard work in making this event possible. And last but not least, to our amazing community, we couldn't have done this without you. For those of you who are new to Buddhist Union Melbourne, we are an Indonesian Buddhist youth community that organize weekly Dhamma talks, temple visits, and other community building events. Our mission is to build a safe community where everyone is included and every opinion is heard. If you're interested to join in on our next event, you can simply follow us on our Instagram and Facebook at BU Melbourne, or you can simply click the link in our Instagram bio to join our WhatsApp group. So once again, thank you so much, everyone. We hope we can all learn valuable lessons from today's talk. Thank you.
All good. Thank you, Jaislyn. So I'm going to read out a few housekeeping rules for today. First, all participants' audios and video functions will be switched off. You will not be allowed to turn it on throughout the entire event. If you do have any questions, please post it on Slido. It is a platform to post your questions, and you can vote for other people's questions as well. That may or may not, well, maybe you would like it. It could be similar and maybe interesting for you. So please scan the QR code over here. And throughout the event itself, our friends will be posting the link continuously on the chat box. So you can click the link and submit your questions there. Please be informed that we will not read out all the questions due to time constraints, but we will be covering those that are most voted on Slido. All good. Next slide, please. Okay, so here we have our donation links. This event is free for everyone to join in, but it would be great if you can help us by supporting to these donation links. One is for the robes and other requisites, and another one is for the Newbury Monastery building fundraising. Okay, so let's now invite Ajahn Brahm to the spotlight. And yeah, I'm gonna read a bit of a bio about you. So yeah, Ajahn Brahm is a popular Buddhist teacher, known internationally, in a growing community of people interested in meditation and deeper spiritual understanding. He's a Cambridge graduate. He started a monastic lifestyle in 1974 at the age of 23, under the late Thai meditation master Ajahn Chah in Bangkok, Thailand. So we invited you from the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Ajahn Brahm moved to Perth in 1983 and became the co-founding monk and abbot of the Bodhayana Monastery, where he resides in until today. He is also known as the author of several books sold internationally. Some of them you might have read before. One of it is called Opening the Door to Your Heart, which has been translated into 24 different languages. So Ajahn Brahm frequently travels throughout the entire world to give talks to large crowds whenever to invite to teach people the path to inner contentment and peace. So he never seems to stop giving and find peace in the present always. Okay, without further ado, Ajahn Brahm, the stage is all yours.
I can't see a stage. All I can see is a screen.
Yes.
But I think it's all mine now. But first of all, that's when you said about all the books which I've written, it's not just one, it's many books. And that's a big problem for me, because I remember that when I was a young lay Buddhist, about 19 or 20, I went to listen to a talk by a Zen monk. Oh, this was some 50 years ago now. And that Zen monk, he gave me some advice. His advice was, be careful, never write a book, because anyone who writes a book has to spend the next 7 lifetimes reborn as a donkey. I've got a lot of donkey reincarnations to live through. So please be kind to any donkeys you meet. It might be one of the nice monks you know who wrote a good book. However, of course, they say such things. And all it really meant to me was to tell me that if you're going to write a book, write it for a very good purpose and in a way which people can understand. Not theory, because people can see theory all over the place, but something which is more relevant to people's lives. And today, of course, the topic of learning what is perfection and imperfection. And how do we deal with it? Then all the years which I've been a monk, I still haven't answered that question. What is perfection, imperfection? So I put it to the side. Instead of worrying, trying to be a perfect monk and trying to overcome my imperfections, instead you make peace with them all. And you find that all of your characteristics, all of your maybe saying the wrong thing or saying a silly joke, all of those things which you say and do, it's just your characteristics. And of course that I use all of these examples from mostly my own life, because I can trust those. I've got a good memory. And I do always remember just growing up and trying to be a perfectionist. Now, trying to be a perfectionist, I'm not quite sure what I had to do to be perfect. And everyone else was telling me what to do, and I wasn't really feeling it in my own heart what I need to do to be perfect. And it's actually know what perfect is. And one of the examples which taught me the meaning of perfection and imperfection, it's an old story from my life, but when I did come over here to Australia, I'm not sure if you know that why I came to Australia, why I arrived in Perth. And the reason was that once I became a monk, and I was so inspired by being a monk with Ajahn Chah, 9 years I stayed with Ajahn Chah, and it was such an inspiring example that I made a vow. I made a determination that I would never ask to go anywhere away from Ajahn Chah. He would have to send me. He would have to say, Ajahn Brahm, you go over here, you go over there. And I would make sure I would stay there until he asked me to come back. So where I lived was up to my teacher, Ajahn Chah. And then what happened, that they needed another monk in Perth, in Western Australia. So he just sent me to Perth. And you know, about 2 or 3 weeks after Ajahn Chah sent me to live in Australia, Ajahn Chah had this stroke. And from that time on, he could not speak anymore. And because Ajahn Chah could not speak, he could not ask me to go back to Thailand or to go anywhere. So I've been stuck here for the last 37 years. And you may think that that's an exaggeration, but it was true. One place is as good as another, in my attitude, at least, you know, usually reasonably good. And it was wonderful being able to stay here and grow with Buddhism in Australia and learn so much. And one of the things which I did learn, this is one of the stories, the early stories, that when we were here, no one really trusted us. I was a young monk. No one knew if I was going to stay the course. And so that we hardly had any donations at all. In fact, we were in debt a lot of the time. And then when we had to build a monastery, oh, that was really hard work. Because I was number two monk at the time, I was the one who, you know, did all the hard work, all the building work. And you may know that I was started off my life as a theoretical physicist in Cambridge. And a theoretical physicist don't do any work. They sit down there and think about equations and the solution to the equations and the meaning of the universe, the astrophysics of the galaxy, the quantum mechanics of subatomic particles, plasma physics, all that really intellectual stuff. You can imagine a quantum physicist a few years later had to learn how to lay bricks. It was quite a shock of, you know, living in your head and now having to connect with your hands and lay bricks. And this was the story of my first brick wall. We could not afford to employ a builder or a professional bricklayer, so I volunteered to do it. But what could be easier than laying bricks? You just put one brick on top of the other and another one, a bit of mortar in between. It's a simple thing to do, in theory. But when you actually try it, oh, those bricks, they don't want to be in line. One corner is too high, so you tap it down, and another corner comes higher, so you tap that one down, and it goes out of line, you tap it in line, another corner goes up. Oh, it's just endless trying to get it perfect. And I didn't realize what my mistake was at the time. I wanted every brick to be perfect. And if it wasn't straight, I would take it off and start again. And then what happened when I finished my first brick wall? To this day, I don't know how this happened, but two bricks were out of line. They were crooked. And they're only two bricks, but to me, they spoiled the whole wall. My two imperfections. And I was so upset by those two bricks. Now, this is no exaggeration. I did have nightmares. I woke up in the middle of the night thinking about those two bad bricks. And I asked the other monk with me, can we afford to buy some explosive to blow the wall up and start again? And he said, no, you can't. You couldn't afford it. So for 3 months, I was stuck, you know, with this terrible wall, the first wall I built. And I thought we'd never get any more donations. No one would help us. We wasted so much money. But then what happened? That I was taking somebody around and they saw that wall and they said it was a beautiful wall. And I could not believe what they said. I asked them, have you left your spectacles in the car? Are you blind? You know, can't you see those two bad bricks? And if you haven't heard this story before, it was a very powerful one, at least for me and for many others. They said, yes, we can see the two bad bricks, but we can also see the 998 perfect bricks as well. And to me, that changed my whole attitude, because the reason why I did not like that wall, the reason why I had nightmares about that wall and that I wanted to blow it up and start again. Number one, because it was my wall. I thought I was responsible for it. And number two, because every time I saw it, my eyes just went to two bricks, my mistakes, and I could not see anything else. I was a blind one. When the person showed me there was more than my two mistakes, I realized he was right. It was a beautiful wall. It's still there today. Over years, I forgot where those bricks were because they weren't important anymore. But what he said was true. It was a beautiful wall. Two bad bricks for 998 good bricks. And later on, when I told this story to a cancer group, you know, people have these terrible diseases like cancers. And again, there's a lot of negativity associated, you know, with that disease. And a lot of fear as well. And how you can deal with that terrible disease, which lasts, you know, much longer than COVID in the human being, and is, you know, much more dangerous. But anyway, that this gentleman who was a builder, he came up to me after I told him that story, and he said, "Ajahn Brahm, please don't be so negative about yourself." He said to me that even professional bricklayers, they make mistakes. So 2 out of 1,000 bricks which are crooked is pretty much par for the course. But then what he said afterwards is the juicy part of this story, the beautiful part of it. He said, in our building industry, whenever we make a mistake like that, we always tell our clients that those crooked bricks are a feature. We charge our customers another couple of $1,000 for them. In other words, you change a mistake into a beautiful feature. What once you regarded as an imperfection becomes a beautiful characteristic of that wall, which sets it apart from others, which gives rise to a joyful appreciation, you know, of your efforts. And what was once a mistake you wanted to blow up now becomes a beautiful part of nature. Of a human being who will never ever be perfect, making something out of kindness, out of generosity, for the happiness of other beings. What can be more beautiful than that? And a couple of crooked bricks, well, that just makes it original, unique. And from that story, which, you know, in the little picture at the front, which showed me with that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, I mentioned that story. I think it's the first story in that book. And I mentioned that because after that was published, that a few years later, I got an invitation to Thailand. And it wasn't from my usual supporters. It was from 3 couples who worked in the Australian Embassy in Bangkok. So, sorry, 4 couples. And they clubbed together. They invited me to Thailand and to visit and give a talk at to the embassy people. And they did that out of gratitude. Because those 4 couples, 2 of those couples had been divorced. They'd gone through the procedures and had been divorced. And the other 2 were separated, you know, looking at having a divorce. When they read that story, the 2 bad bricks, the 4 couples came back together again and lived in peace and harmony together. And I was just so touched by that, how powerful these stories can be. What once can be perfection, I wanted to blow up the wall. What once can be a problem in your relationship with your partner, to the point you want to go through a separation and a divorce, you can look at it another way. And that can keep you together in peace and harmony. It really starts to show you what, you know, this thing we call love is. It's not just loving yourself, it's just loving others as well. Because you'll never find a perfect person in this world to live with. And they won't be able to find a perfect person either, because you're not perfect. I love senses of humor, because this this very well-known, I won't say her name, a very well-known person over in Singapore, she told me, and it was a true story about her marriage. She had a very successful marriage. But she said when she, you know, chose her partner in life and they decided to, you know, to put the rings on and get married, that after the marriage ceremony, her father took aside his new son-in-law just to have a little bit of advice for the new member of his family, the man who'd married his daughter. And he told his son-in-law, he said, "Son-in-law, now you probably love my daughter so much." He said, "Oh, yes. She's the most beautiful girl in the whole of Singapore. She's so charming and kind and caring. Oh, I feel so lucky to have married her." I don't know if that looks convincing to you, because I'm a monk, I'd never be married. So, but anyway, that's what sort of thing she said. And anyway, the father-in-law said to the new son-in-law, yeah. "That's what it's like when you fall in love and get married. You feel that your partner is the most wonderful person in the world. How lucky you are to have met them, and that they have committed to you, you've committed to them. Oh, it's so much joy and happiness." But, he said, "Please keep this in mind. My daughter is not perfect. I'm her father. I know about her imperfections and faults and things wrong with her. But I always want you to remember this. Right now, you can't see those imperfections. Maybe 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years' time, around that period, you'll start to become aware of her faults and imperfections. But when you do become aware of those imperfections, please remember these words. If my daughter did not have those imperfections to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you." And as he said that, they had a wonderful relationship together, because they both knew that, you know, they had their imperfections and faults. So if you have a relationship with someone, please keep that in mind, that they've got imperfections and faults, and you have those imperfections and faults. So, what does that mean? It means you're a good match. A good match for each other. So don't try and seek the perfect partner in life, or the perfect job, or the perfect city, or the perfect monastery, or the perfect monk, or the perfect. Those things don't exist. And if they did, it would be very dull in that existence. It's where you have the imperfections. You meet the imperfections in yourself and in others. If it's in others, that's where you learn what love is. You can't love someone if they're perfect. You love someone because they're imperfect. That love just makes that extra little amazing thing that, you know, you sometimes drive me crazy. Sometimes, you know, you forget to do the right things. But nevertheless, I love you and I care for you. There's something which is much stronger than admiration. If you want a perfect partner in this world, someone who always loves you and always cares for you, never says anything wrong about you, never sort of, is always happy to see you no matter just, you know, what they feel. If you want someone who always loves you like that, who never sort of argues with you, is always there for you, then get a dog. The dog always wags its tail when you see it. Always happy to see you. Never gets upset at you. If you get a partner, whoa, it's a different ball game. But whatever, you can actually change that to have a much wider idea of love, which actually sees something much better than just wanting perfections in life. Then after a while, you say, well, who says what is perfect? You know, first of all, you know, this is the youth group, you know, young people. And I think you may still be suffering from even not believing what your parents say is the perfect girl, the perfect boy. What is perfect? How much do you have to do to fulfill your parents' expectations of you? So they're very, very happy with who you are. And I tell you, it's almost impossible. No matter what you do, you'll never live up to your parents' wishes and expectations, because they're unrealistic. So what you do, what a lot of parents would want of their child, imagine that you had a child, that you gave birth to a boy or a girl, and what would you want for them to be in life? And sometimes your idea of what perfection is maybe not what your parents thought. It's not just like being a great scholar and being a professor or being rich. What most people want for the people they care about is that they're happy. Simple thing. They're peaceful. They're happy in themselves, and also they give happiness to others. You know, those two things are the same. You cannot have inner happiness without sharing your happiness with others. That is, when you give to others, you care for others, you sacrifice yourself to others, you give your time to someone else, that gives this huge amount of happiness inside of you, and energy too. Here's one little story which you probably haven't heard, because this was, you know, one of those monastic stories I usually tell to the monks I train. In those early years when I was a monk in Thailand, I've been a monk now for 46 years. It's quite a long time. And the problem with being a monk for so long is that you can't look forward to your retirement. We don't retire as monks. We don't have any superannuation. I don't have any pensions. I can't retire. Anyway, you don't want to retire because I enjoy my life. But when those early years in Thailand, when you become a monk in that part of the world, you have to make yourself your three basic robes. And you have white cloth. You have to cut it to the right size. And there's a special pattern you have to sew on the outside. And then you have to dye it. And there's the three robes, and they're very big. And then you dye it, but you can't dye it with some chemical dye from the chemist shop. You do it, in that part of the world, from jackfruit wood. There's so many jackfruit trees there, and when a branch comes off or one dies, then they always offer it to the monastery. And we use that wood to actually extract the dye and use it in our robes. It's one of the reasons why, you know, for Theravada monks, it's like a brown color, because that's the dye from the jackfruit tree. And anyway, it's really hard work. The 3 days, and you cannot take a break, because when you're dyeing the robe, you have to keep turning it, otherwise the dye just streaks and leaves a very terrible mess of your robe. So it's usually a long time, 72 hours at least, full on work with no opportunity to rest or have a break. And so these couple of monks, or the 3 of them, they were making their robes, and I felt so sorry for them, because when you haven't slept for 2 or 3 days, you know, you look so sort of sickly and tense and unhappy. So that evening, after the evening meeting, I went up to them in the dyeing shed, a little area of the monastery put aside for this project. And I told them, I won't say anything if you don't. Go to bed, have a rest. I will look after the dye pot tonight for you. And one of the things I always remember about that, it was just an act of kindness to others, was they never argued with me. They were off before I could even sort of say the next sentence. They took the opportunities to go to bed and have a sleep. You know, you've probably had times when you haven't rested well, and especially if that builds up over 1 or 2 days, oh, you feel terrible. And so I'd rested the night before, so I would do that for you. So anyway, I did the dye pot all night, and when the bell went at 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd get up in that part of Thailand in those days. When the monastery bell was rang, I just saw them coming, and they came to the dyeing shed and took over. And they were so grateful. They looked so different having had a sleep. And I just went and to the morning meeting. So I hadn't even visited my kuti, my hut at all. I went from the evening meeting to the dyeing shed to the morning meeting. But the strange thing was, I had so much energy that morning. My meditation was so clear. The chanting, I could remember everything in the chanting, because we chant over there in Pali and in Thai as well. And it's a lot to remember for a young monk. But I was full of energy, and even just cleaning up afterwards and then getting your bowl and going on arms round. Oh, it was so energetic. It was like, you know, I didn't have any coffee in those days, or, you know, tea or anything to boost you up. And it was a natural energy. I could not believe it. How come? that had so much inside of me. And I asked one of the other monks there. And of course, I was only a young monk. I didn't know how the mind worked. What they told me was it was because I had selflessly helped others. I'd given up my time, my comfort, just to spend a few hours helping with dyeing a robe and giving them a chance to have a rest. And when I saw that in my own heart and body and mind, it's how wonderful it is to serve and give and care for others. I realized that that is a great source of caring for yourself. So that is one of the reasons why, you know, it's important that we learn just to love ourselves is loving others. And loving others is loving ourselves. That they all go together. And then, who's perfect? Who's imperfect? It's not the person who's perfect, not the person who's imperfect. It's the relationship we have between us. That is where the perfection and imperfection lie. How do you regard yourself? What is your relationship to yourself? It's not that you're imperfect. It's not that you're perfect. But your relationship to yourself, the way you look at yourself, the way you treat yourself, that could be imperfect. And also the relationship you have with others. Is that a perfect relationship you have with others or an imperfect one? And that's something you can really work with and do a lot of improvement on our relationships. And to make a strong point about that, that I don't know why as a monk I have to do these things, but one of the things which I'm often called to do is to do marriage blessings. And I don't know why they ask a monk who's been a Buddhist been a celibate for 46 years. I'm a monk. What do I know about marriage? I must know something because I get so many invitations to bless people's marriages. You know it works. That's why they keep asking me back again and keep coming to the temple and to see how many successful relationships you can create. And one of the stories I say there, which is so beautiful, because it surprises people. I did this just a few days ago with a couple. You know, I usually start with the bride. She's just been married. The formal part has been finished, and now I just give some advice. And I look at her eyes, and you know, she's just so struck with, you know, happiness and joy that it's a marriage day. And I tell her, you're a married woman now. From this day on, from this moment on, you must never, ever think of yourself. She understands, and so she nods yes. And then I look at the guy who's standing next to her, and I say the same thing to him. You're a married man now. It's not about you anymore. You mustn't think of yourself. And he also agrees. And then I keep looking at him and say, also, from this day on, you must never think of your wife, of her. And that's when it gets interesting, because I love this part. People actually start to listen because they don't understand. They respect me, so they know I'm not telling a joke here. This is something deep. But they haven't seen it. From this day on, you must not think of your wife. Then I look at her and say the same to her. From this moment on, please don't think of him. And while they're trying to figure out what this means, I tell them the solution. It's what I call these days a third option. It's not just being selfish, and just what's in it for you. It's not just being sacrificial and giving everything to other people, which leads to burnout. I say, when you're married, it's never about me, never about my partner. It's only about us. We're in it together. We're a partnership. We're married. We're husband and wife. It has to be about not me, not you, us. And such a simple thing, but people actually get it. Which means that if there's any problem in the marriage, any difficulty, any imperfection. How do you solve it? It's not her fault. It's not his fault. It's not my fault. It is our fault. In other words, we find the solution together. We figure out what we need to do. When you do stuff like that, you find out the relationship goes to another level. It's not about me anymore. It's not about blaming somebody else. It's always about us. And I mention that for a marriage because that should be pretty obvious. That's just how people can have a happy time together. But that's also with friendships as well. It's also in business, in companies. Must always be about us. Many of you may be students at university. You know, the one thing which I really disliked about university was the exams. Not that I was bad at exams. I used to pass them all, the distinctions and stuff. I was good at exams. But the thing I didn't like about exams was I had to sit next to my friend. He was only just maybe half a meter away. And I could see him struggling with a problem. And I wanted to help him. But I couldn't. If I tried to help him, it would be called cheating. To me, it was called compassion, kindness. What's wrong with helping a friend when you know the answer they don't? What's wrong with that? I saw things in a different way. In examinations, it's all about the person, individualism, ego, sense of self, me beating my best friend. That never made sense to me, even when I was young. I mean, of course, it never makes sense in life either. It's not which is the best Buddhist society in Melbourne. Who is the best Buddhist group in Melbourne? Who's the best Buddhist in the best Buddhist group? That doesn't make any sense to me at all. What it makes a lot of sense is because we're in this together. We have this beautiful relationship together. That's what we make perfect. Because it's out of kindness and joy. You can make that perfect. You can't make a person perfect. Person is just basically part of nature. And being a forest monk, you learn so much from nature. One of the things which I learned from nature, I tell this story almost every week, but it's such a beautiful story, it keeps coming up. This story began its life during a mental health week, when I was invited to a seminar on mental health here in Perth, in Australia. And I was willing to give a hand, whereas it's about us. And so I was asked to give a little session for, they called it clients of the mental health service. In other words, the people who were being through terrible, terrible situations and were still being treated by psychologists, psychiatrists, and goodness knows who else. And also a few of the professionals, the people who were looking after them, sitting in the back. And I remember just going in there and just telling them about the story of the trees in the forest. It's one of my favorite stories because I'm a forest monk. I live in forests, Australian forests, over in Thailand, so many jungles I would go to, even in Sri Lanka, Indonesia, in the concrete jungle. But sometimes you get to nice forests as well, and jungles, and beautiful places. And anyway, that I said that next time you go into a forest, or even a wood somewhere, please try and find a perfect tree. And by a perfect tree, I even defined it for them. One which is straight, with all the branches and the twigs perfectly aligned. And with only green leaves, no yellow or brown leaves, and the green leaves with no bugs on them. You can see when the trees have been affected by some bugs because they get eaten and chewed.
apologies for the technical issue, everyone. We'll be in touch with Ajahn Brown. We hope that he can reconnect soon.
Hi everyone. Meanwhile, if you have any question, you can just scan the QR code on your screen right now and you can post your question to Slido. You can also upvote any questions that you find interesting so we can ask those questions. Thank you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Hello. Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. I reckon it was because, you know, that there's this person in Buddhism called Mara. And whenever you do a really good talk, Mara comes in and messes around with your computer.
But all is good now.
Yeah, well, it's
all
good
right.
Now. Yay.
Back in line.
Back in line. So, I was saying about the trees in the forest. And there's no such thing as a perfect tree. In fact, if there was, it'd be boring. And I always actually like, when you have a photograph taken, if you go to sit somewhere, you always go and sit under an imperfect tree. One which is all twisted and bent and crooked. Those are the trees I like the best. They're beautiful. To me, a perfect tree has got a long distance from beauty. And beauty has all these marks on the trunk, you know, from bushfires or other trees falling down and hitting it. That is the beautiful trees. And so I told all these clients of the mental health service in Western Australia, say, number one, you know, you're damaged. You've been twisted and hurt by life. And it means that you belong. You belong in this wonderful forest called humanity. If you don't believe me, just go and see how many twisted and bent trees belong. in a real forest. And number two, the more twisted you are, the more damaged you are, the more I like to go and visit you and to be with you and sit underneath you, the most damaged trees and the most beautiful ones. And so what I was teaching here is to change one's attitude, you know, towards what people say is not good enough, or is imperfect, or is wrong, or is bad, to see the beauty in that. And one of the places I really learned that very strongly was visiting prisons, visiting jails. And please excuse me, but you know, this actually happened, that there was one prisoner in our local jail, and you know, he was a very wonderful man, a very good friend, very kind, very skilled, but he was in jail for a terrible crime which he committed, and that we were holding a retreat, just in our retreat center close to the monastery where I live, and we didn't have a cook for the retreat. And so we talked to the local prison officers. They said, can he come to cook for us? And just in the morning time, because we don't have the meal in the evening. And there's a volunteer. And he was really into it. And the prison said, yeah, why not? So he became his own work release from prison. He was our cook. And he was one of those fantastic cooks. Even, I couldn't believe that, you know, he'd make a pizza every day. He'd make the pizza himself from flour. He'd make the dough and bake the pastry or whatever and put amazing things on it. And he cooked such a lot of food for everybody. He put his love into it. And people commented on what a wonderful cook he was. Where did you find him? It was the last day of the retreat. I told people where we found him. He was a prisoner in our local jail. And he was in there for rape. A very big, violent man. When I told him at the end, he was a very damaged, twisted tree. But they realized they got to love him and care for him, the man he'd given them. If I'd have told them that the very first day of the retreat, they'd have all left out of fear. When they found out afterwards, they realized that the way they judged people was a problem. He was a very kind, good man. He's out now, he's got married, he's having a wonderful life, a very brilliant man. You can't judge a person for one or two mistakes, even bad mistakes, terrible mistakes, which hurt other people. Keeping him in jail doesn't help anybody. As long as he's safe to be outside, then why not? Anyway, so that really showed just how our relationships to imperfections in other people and in ourselves. Imagine what that must feel like if for some reason or another you've done some terrible, terrible things in your life, some terrible crimes. How does that feel? Please change your relationship to that act. You can't judge yourself by one or two bad bricks you've laid in your life. And I'm sorry, this is my character. You know, that there was another prisoner in that jail who read my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, especially like that story of the two bad bricks. Because he was in jail for a murder, actually two murders. And he said, it was only two murders. It doesn't make me a murderer. There's two bad bricks in the wall of my life. And it's not sort of demeaning the harm and pain he caused to others. But at least for him, he had some understanding about perfection and imperfection and how to transcend both. Have the relationship to this world. When mistakes happen, we do wrong things. We acknowledge them. We don't try and say that it didn't happen. We don't lie. We accept. And we forgive. No punishments. The punishments which just... That is a very bad relationship we have to ourselves and to others. Wanting to hurt someone because hurt has happened in our life. Instead of that, we forgive. We don't sort of accept and say, what a wonderful thing you've done by two murders. That's a ridiculous thing to think. It's a terrible thing which happened. But we forgive. We want you to learn and grow and become much bigger than those terrible things which you did. Which means that every time that there's mistakes in life, what sometimes people call imperfections, we learn they're not really deserve that word, imperfections. They're just being a human being who makes mistakes. Under difficult situations, you know, does things which we sometimes regret for the rest of our lives. When those things happen, we learn from them, we grow from them, we become kinder because of them. It is the university of life, our relationships to the faults and imperfections change, and we have this wonderful relationship with ourselves and others and the imperfections of life. We care rather than always trying to cure the mistakes of life. And I'm not saying that cure doesn't happen by caring. Caring for the forests, caring for the environment, caring for the people who do bad things, caring for ourselves, caring for our parents, caring for everything we can. Then we cure so many terrible pains and sufferings of our life. Care is our path, not curing. And imperfections are part of life. We care for them, we live with them. But in your life, if you're studying, you do the best you can. But I have this whole list of great people who either got kicked out of university or just left of their own free will. Anyone from Bill Gates to Steve Jobs to Michael Dell to Zuckerberg. So tell your parents if you, you know, if you feel like you want to leave university and they object. Tell them all these wonderful people who actually left university and become so successful. And even kids. Well, some kids, they go through their exams and they said, I got an F in science. And I asked them, did any of your teachers explain what F means? F means fabulous, fantastic, well done. You get an E, E means excellent. And any kid who gets an A, you know what A means? Arrogant. In other words, you change the whole idea about judging, and instead you just learn. In life, in school, university, you're learning, you're growing, you're understanding the relationship you have to yourself and to life. And that is how we deal with imperfections. And my clock now says an hour has gone past. So I hope that's correct. So, MC, shall we start the questions now?
Yes. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the wonderful Dhamma talk. It was very interesting and insightful. Hello, everyone. My name is Jocelyn, and I will be facilitating the Q&A for today. As mentioned by Quincy before, please post your question to Slido, and the link is in the chat box and upvote questions that you want to be answered. So in the spirit of Katina or rope offering ceremony, we are offering everyone a chance to support the Sangha, which, Donnie, the QR code, please. Yeah. So on your screen very shortly, you will see the QR code for the donations link for the rope offering and other requisite on the left. The rope offering event will be live streamed tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Melbourne time on the Buddhist Society of Victoria's YouTube channel. And further information are available on the BSV's Facebook page. The QR code on the right is a donation link to support the Newbury Buddhist Monastery Building Project, a monastery that is supported by the BSVs, which is located around 1 hour drive from Melbourne. Okay, without further ado, let's start our Q&A questions. So the first question here is that, can we use our perfection in a positive way to become a better person, or perfection only makes us stress and end up becoming a dukkha? So what's your thought on this?
I remember about the relationship you have to yourself. You try your very best, see what you can do. And whatever positive things which you get, the 998 good bits in a row, celebrate them. Celebrate the wonderful effect of your kind actions and your goodness. But don't try to be perfect, because that's an impossible thing. And that will cause so much stress and so much disappointment. You just can't do it. And a lot of people just give up. And that's not a thing to do in our modern world. We can't just give up and just not care about others, not care about ourselves, and keep on going. And we just caring more important than curing, because caring is about attitude. Curing is about results. But it's not about results. It's not where you end up. It's how you get there.
Yes, we have quite a lot of questions here. So I'll just continue to the second question.
Yeah.
So this person is fighting with a very bad addiction. Every time he or she did that, she or he feels so guilty and decided to just give up on fighting that addiction. So how to stop that addiction?
Yeah, it's just remember why we just need to fight addictions. There's always something I've found in life that when people have any addiction towards anything, there's always some sense of lack of self-worth, not seeing the goodness inside of themselves. So one very simple thing to do, it's a very often thing I've said before, is take a piece of paper, a line down the middle, your name on the top, and on the left-hand side, write all the bad things about yourself, all the terrible, terrible things about you. Be honest, because you're the only one who's going to see this. Be honest with it and fill the left-hand side, but don't go over to the right-hand side, because on the right-hand side of that piece of paper, I want you to put down all the wonderful things about yourself, all the good stuff. When I did that with one of the prisoners in the jail, the left-hand side, he filled up so quickly, all the bad stuff he had done in life. Right-hand side says, nothing good about me. No, nothing good about me. He said, look, I know from the other prisoners you look after the cat, the prison cat. So what do you do with the cat this morning? He said, I gave it a saucer of milk. Put that down. He did. Gave the cat a saucer of milk. And once he started seeing one good thing in him, he could start to see many other good things in him. And he filled out that right-hand side with all the good qualities in him. And then I got the scissors, cut it down the middle, left-hand side, all his bad qualities I threw in waste bin. The right-hand side, I asked him to photocopy it, laminate many copies as he can, and put it all around his room, in his bag, wherever he goes. Reminds him of his good qualities. Reminding of your good qualities, not your faults, is one of the most wonderful ways to overcome addictions. Things which hurt you, you take those things, you keep having those addictions, it's almost a sense of self-punishment. You're not good enough. So you want to sort of escape from this world, you want to escape from yourself. So reminding yourself of your wonderful qualities, it overcomes those addictions.
Thank you for that question. We actually did a journaling workshop yesterday, which actually helped with releasing your emotions. If you want to have a look at that, it's actually available on BSV's YouTube channel. Yeah, so we'll go to the next one. Is it right to often pretend everything is okay while we were feeling blue, burnt out, and things like that? Or is it categorized as rejection of reality?
It's called lying. You're not being truthful. If you're really terrible and burnt out, just tell your friends, oh, I feel like a piece of feces. I was going to say something else. But just have a rest. Find out little ways. In monasteries, that sometimes monks and nuns do go through difficult stuff. And so what we do, I let you into a secret here, in Bodhinyana Monastery, where I teach, we have a little section in the library for monks only. And you have some books in there for monks who have a difficult time, while they're a monk. And there's Calvin and Hobbes cartoons, other cartoons, cartoon books, which some of them are very, very funny. And they can actually have a look at those books just to start to cheer themselves up. But they acknowledge, first of all, when you feel a bit down. And you don't deny it. And you have your strategies all planned out beforehand. When you're down, you can't think of any strategies. You prepare the strategies for difficulties beforehand. Just like bushfires in the east or in where I live. You prepare before the bushfire comes. So when there's a fire, we know exactly what to do and we do it and we escape with no problem at all. The same when you get depressed, you get overworked, you get stressed. Then you have all your strategies and exactly what you're supposed to do. And then you act that way. And then which means the stress doesn't last that long. So anyway, I'm sure you've seen this before, but it's such a good simile. How to deal with burnout. You see my cup here? How heavy is my cup of water? That's better. Yeah. The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 2 minutes, my arm is aching. 3 minutes, I'm in great pain. What should I do when this gets too heavy to bear?
Let it go.
Let it go. Put it down. Rest. And after 1 minute, you pick it up again. It works again. In only 10 seconds, it feels lighter. Simply because your arm has rested. The reason why people get stressed out and very negative, that when they have a problem in life, they just keep pushing, keep trying to fix it up instead of just putting it down for a while. Relaxing, resting. And then when it comes up again, you find you're much more competent, stronger, able to deal with it.
Thank you for that wonderful answer. So there's this question from Hilda. How to deal with people who don't want to admit their mistakes and trying to always impose things that they believe are right?
Well, they can try and impose things which they think is right. But you should, what you do, you say, I listen to you. I'm letting you know all my tricks now. I listen to you and I say, well, I will think about it. You never say no to such people because they're control freaks. You say no, they'll argue with you. But if you say you're going to think about it, then they'll let you think about it. And there's some things which I've been thinking about for years. Which means I don't need to give an answer to them because it's a stupid request which they give. So you just put it off. Have some emotional responses which they can't argue with. So when people try and impose, you know, what they think is right on you, just say, well, I'll think about it. And then go off and do what you normally do. What you know is the correct thing. And when people think they don't make mistakes, they're perfect. My experience of life is that there's not one person in the world like that. They may portray to you that they are perfect, but they know that they're not. Even as some of those prisoners I see in jail, there's not one, I never met one, who doesn't admit what they've done was wrong and that what a terrible thing it was. And they think every day if they could go back in time, they would never do that again. So we do all have this thing called guilt, conscience. And even those people who think they're perfectionists, they have that as well. They don't like doing that. But it's not all they know how to deal with life. So anyway, those are a couple of reflections there. And people think they're a perfectionist. Just let them act that way. Just like Shakespeare saying that all the world's a stage. And they're acting what they think is what they need to do. And just, you can't stop them. That would just make them more of a control freak. Just say, oh, I'll think about that. And they soon they realize they can't control you. And when they care for you, they're kind, you can give so much more to them. Bosses get so much more work done when you care for your the people who work for you. I think you might say that I've been a very successful monk over my career, built many monasteries, written many books. And all that time, I haven't controlled anybody and told them what to do. But I've cared for people a lot. Because I care for people a lot, if I need something, they just come and do it. It's a wonderful way of being a manager, of being so kind and caring that people are looking for things to do to help you out.
Do you have any advice on people that aspire for perfection? Like, call themselves perfectionists and setting the bar too high for themselves.
Yeah, you're just suffering. Because after a while you learn it's just a stupid thing to do. And after a while, after a while you realize you're good enough. It's a wonderful thing to see that, you know, your people really do love you and care for you. Now, they never tell you that. They never tell you you should improve. They say, I love you as you are. I care for you just exactly as you are. If you become better, I'll care for that too. But you don't have to struggle and strive so much to, you know, win my affection. Imagine you met someone like that. Whoa! You know, you'd serve them and care for them back because they're inspiring you. You meet for someone who says, well, yeah, I'll love you if I give you all these things you need to fulfill and do to have their life. That's impossible. No, kindness, metta, is not a business deal. Metta is something which lets go of the sense of self, of me and mine, and it just wants to disappear and just be kind to people. Not own anything, but just to give. So such people, they want to own you. And don't be a possession of others.
So the next question is, I find it difficult to connect accepting our imperfect self and at the same time wanting to improve ourselves. How to avoid beating ourselves when we fail to improve?
Well, you find that when you try to improve, that's when you fail. That's when you end up beating yourself. It's a negative cycle. You don't try to improve. In other words, you care and accept yourself as you are. That's when improvement starts. You're improving your relationship with yourself, your relationship with your studies. And to the point comes when, like studies, you really start to enjoy it. You know, to me, when I was doing maths, it wasn't sort of work. I enjoyed doing maths. It was like doing a puzzle. And I love doing puzzles and finding solutions. I never beat myself up and said, wow, this is really good. Give me more. And I loved it. And we had that sort of attitude to being a monk. Well, I don't beat myself up if I fail. I don't get up in the morning or I fall asleep when I'm meditating or something. Ah, just poor old Ajahn Brahm. Oh, poor Ajahn Brahm. You must be very tired. You're getting old. Yeah, it's okay. So that kindness that you have to yourself, that is not being lazy. That is not just going nowhere. The kindness and the peace you give to yourself is the start of improvement. You start to unlock all these wonderful qualities which you have inside yourself. This wonderful knowledge, ability to work, serve, give, whatever. When you're at peace with yourself, oh, you can give so much to the world. So if you really want to improve, be kind to yourself.
The next question is actually related. What if they have accepted their imperfections, but their boss and colleagues would not let them forget about their imperfections, and are they not good enough for them? What should they do?
Well, again, you find that it's amazing that what actually works in the office and in business, people love having people around who are just kind and caring, and, you know, who are very productive because, you know, they are at peace with themselves. You know, when we're thinking about what does my boss think about me, then you can't really do a very good work of, you know, writing out the contract or something. You're just worried all the time, the stress of, you know, is this good enough, instead of actually doing it with your heart and really producing the very, very best. There's so many examples of bosses who were kind. One of the monks reminded me of this a few days ago. There's a building company in United Kingdom called Farrelly and Sons. And they decided in the board meeting to ban all overtime. Everybody at the end of the day had to go home to their family and friends. They could not stay any longer. They could not also take any work home with them. All work had to be done in the office. They couldn't take papers back. And what happened next was that the profits doubled, turnover trebled in 1 year. And they won this big business award, a very simple strategy of kindness and care, made their company just winning a great, great big prize. Never think that kindness and care don't work.
That's actually pretty interesting. When you let people go home and they become more productive?
Yes. Because, you know, their family life, their social life doesn't interfere with their business life. You know, they go back, they can rest. They can look after their kids and their wife, their husband. And they can, when they go to work on a Monday morning or the next morning, they feel, yeah, let's do something for this company. And they really appreciated the kindness and the care of the bosses. So they wanted to work harder for them. So it became a much more pleasant experience. Apparently they also said, I remember the article, that the turnover of the staff in that company fell to almost zero. Nobody wanted to leave. But it was a win-win all over.
So our next question is about how to distinguish between gratitude and laziness to develop by continuing to think that whatever we get right now is enough and nothing is perfect.
It's because whatever I get is enough. What about what you can give? Have you given enough yet? You can always give some more. To give some more, you need something to give. So when you think just about you, that can be lazy. But when it's about just sharing with others, it's not about me, it's about us, then of course you always work. You always work in a wise, caring way. And then you get wonderful results. It's not laziness. Oh, you can't be lazy. Sometimes I wonder, well, I've given enough in the world. I became a monk. I became a monk to have an easy life. Not quite. I don't work too hard. But it's like, it's not laziness. It's like caring. And it makes you very, very hard working, but having a happy time working.
The next question is, how do we get past of failures in which we have put in a lot of effort but unable to succeed? How do we move on?
You do it again. You fail your driving test, put a lot of effort into that, then take it again, see what happens. Or if it's a not really an important test, university degree, that's not that important. You can always retake it if you really feel it's important for you. Then never take failure as the end of a path. The failure opens up more opportunities, more things to do, more things to understand. And you say, why did I fail? Why didn't I get the mark? Is it really a failure? I did the work. I met so many wonderful people. I enjoyed my life so much there. Is that a failure? Sometimes just doing the work and entering that course, that's enough. And then nothing becomes a failure to you. It becomes just more interesting stuff in the world which we learn from.
Yeah, there is a saying from the previous speaker. She said that you sometimes have to go down before you can bounce back up again. And sometimes going down doesn't always mean going backward. It can be a progress to go forward.
Absolutely, yeah. I love to stay in caves. It's a wonderful place to meditate. You have to go down to get in the cave. I love that. You have to go to bed at night. You have to go down. Lay down. Whatever. So going down doesn't mean you're failing. And just failing is just, things don't work out as you expected. You don't get the results. But the process you went through was so important. The fact that you did the course. The fact you just tried that thing that wanted to do. You learned so much in the process. So you don't really sort of judge the whole thing which you did just on pass or fail.
Yeah. So the next question we have here is that how to be less judgmental towards oneself and others?
Look, how can you judge yourself? Now, be rational about this. How much do you know about yourself and why you do things and how you work and all the karmic influence and all the other influence and what your abilities are and what your abilities aren't? And it's impossible to judge yourself. If I was a judge in the court of law, I would never be able to judge anybody. I would just say, well, I don't know, maybe if I was in the same situation you were in, had the same parents, the same sort of mind and brain and body and situation, I don't know what I might have done. How can you judge? You can't really. So you make a tentative judgment. Yeah, that's a silly thing to do because it causes people pain. Let's try and learn from that. But don't take judgments of even yourself too seriously. And how can you judge others? I really find it great fun, people judging me, a monk. They haven't got a clue what goes on in my life or in my brain or in my mind. But still they like to judge, who you are. Sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're so lazy. You get a proper job instead of being just a parasite on society. You don't contribute, you just sit there and people feed you. Then, you know, aren't you guilty about that? No? Because I do work and I enjoy work. Sometimes it's hard for me to think of it as work. Because it's, you know, being kind, I'm enjoying myself. Talking or laying bricks, serving, whatever you can do. It's a wonderful life. So it's so hard to judge others. And it's impossible to judge others, really. Can't even judge yourself.
So how do you overcome the overthinking that sometimes arises from those negative thoughts about yourself?
The negative. By changing them to some positive thoughts. Again, just like that piece of paper, you write down the line in the middle and just the good qualities on one side, bad qualities on the other side. Which is the right side of the paper? Which is the wrong side of the paper? I usually say just throw away the rubbish side of the paper because I think it's much more helpful for you. You know, in your houses, on your phones, you probably have the most wonderful photographs of the nicest events of your life. You never have the terrible photographs. You know, you go to your parents' home, they have the pets, you know, the signs of their marriage and going on holiday somewhere, the children graduating, have all sorts of positive attitudes which you photograph and put in your camera or on your wall to remind you of happiness. You never have pictures of you sick in hospital, studying late at night trying to get the assignment in time, being stuck in the traffic, having arguments with your partner. You never have photographs of that. You have the positive attitudes there, the positive photographs, because they uplift us. They create health and happiness. They encourage us to look for the beauty in life, which is there. To look for the beauty in ourselves, which is there. And after a while, that we don't get negative about ourselves anymore.
So there's a question here about Ajahn being... Ajahn mentioned that Ajahn will go to wherever the teacher is assigned to and finally end up in Perth.
Yeah.
They wonder if that is considered as a destiny or choice.
I don't know. But anyway, it happens. I don't like complicating things. Is it destiny or choice? But it was happy. I enjoyed it. Made the most of it. Had a wonderful time here. And I still managed to go overseas. I have to come back here. But sometimes I like the idea of stability. Of actually staying and, you know, giving to people you know. And some of the people which I've known here, they literally, they were the kids they came, first of all. Now they're adults and they're all like family members. Not sort of blood relations. You've known them for so well for such a long time. And that includes many of the people in Melbourne. Because I've been going to Melbourne for I don't know how many years. Unfortunately, last year I could not go because of COVID. But, you know, so many friends, relations, people I've known for such a long time over there. And so staying in one place a long time, you do build up relationships, trust, kindness. People understand you and you understand them. And that's a wonderful thing in this life. That, you know, many of you, maybe it's just not your place where you were born in Melbourne, but you know you're here, you're stuck here, you've made your lots of friends and people you love and care for. Stay and develop those relationships even deeper and further. These are your friends. And quite frankly, the friends you make at this time of your life, they are the friends for life. You can't choose your family members. You're born in it. You make the best you can with them. But the friends, they're forever. Well, in this life anyway.
There's a question here about, as a children, when your parents fight or encounter problems, should we keep ourselves out of it so that they can find a solution for themselves, or?
Well, you know, it really depends what type of problem it is. But it's very difficult, actually, to teach parents. You know, I'm supposed to be a good teacher, but when my mother was alive, there's no way I could teach her. Because it's the psychology. The mother gave birth to you. The father looked after you when you're tiny. And just the psychology doesn't really allow you to teach your parents. Now, even the Buddha's chief disciple, Sariputta, could not teach his mum. He's tried many times. And his mum kept sort of saying bad things about him. Sariputta, when are you going to get a proper job? That's in the commentaries in the, to the suttas, and it's very funny to read. But this is Venerable Sariputta with all the psychic powers, fully enlightened and everything. Whoa. His mother still sort of told him off. But anyway, so don't ever think that you can teach your parents. But well, you can do things which are a little bit more roundabout. You can, you know, mention it like a book to them or mention the strategy to them. So you can help in roundabout ways, but not directly.
So when they're having an argument, let's say, so should we keep out of it or should we interfere?
Yeah, no, keep out of it. And then just look at them. I said, Mum, Dad, you know, that's, you know, you're my mother and father. Is this what you're teaching me? Have arguments? But no, people have arguments. That's part of life. So don't worry about arguments. But just make sure that they make up afterwards. And they realize having arguments with their friends and loved ones, their family. All those arguments we have, what about remembering all those wonderful times we shared together? And going out, having a wonderful time. So remember the beautiful part of your partner, and then that changes the whole attitude to them. If you remember their faults, you get arguments. No one wins in an argument. If you had the wisest professor of philosophy arguing with the chief judge because they were married together, no one would win. It doesn't matter how wise you are, how much knowledge and facts you have, you cannot argue with your wife, with your husband. No matter what they say, they won't believe you. That's why we have all these wonderful strategies which I mentioned. If it's like people are married, we have what's called the calendar method of living together in peace and harmony. The calendar method works like this, if you haven't heard it before, is if you're having an argument and you have to make some decision, you decide what day of the month it is. If it's an odd day of the month, or what day is today? 31st today, it's an odd day of the month. And the odd days of the month, the female is always right. So it doesn't matter, you know, what the facts say, the woman is always right on the 31st of October. And the man is always right on the even days of the month, like the 30th. That way, it's, you know, pretty fair. And I think many of you are smart enough to realize there are many more odd days of the month than there are even days. But it's worth it for a peaceful life together. So you guys, just give in. On the even days, you're right. On the odd days, she's right. And then there's no arguments.
I didn't realize that at first. So there is this, actually they're asking for, so they really love the example that you gave regarding the brick wall. Is there any other similes that or metaphors that you have for to keep in mind?
Yeah, it's just, again, well, metaphors that sometimes that we try and cure ourselves and cure other people to try and become better people. And this is the story of the doctor. I already mentioned that because I've been here for 37 years now or something, that many of the people who were little children when I first came here are now professionals. And this case applies to this Sri Lankan doctor. When he came here, he was just a little kid playing around. And he went through school and high school and university and medical school. And he was a first year as a doctor in the hospital. And he had a terrible, terrible morning. He came to see me in the afternoon on Saturday. And he said that he needed to resign. He just, he couldn't be a doctor anymore. And he was really serious about this. And he came to see me because he trusted me. And I said, what happened? And he told me that one of his patients, a 23-year-old girl, or somewhere around that age, had tragically died unexpectedly. And it was his patient. He tried everything, but he couldn't keep her alive. and he had to go and tell the news to her husband, this young man who was so deeply in love together, and to see the husband literally emotionally just get so distraught, the woman he committed his life to had unexpectedly passed away, and that he had to tell his two young children they had no more mummy. And as a sort of empathetic person, that just went, it was like three knives went right inside of him and just churning his heart. He felt so guilty. That's why he said, I needed to resign. I can't do this anymore in case that happened again. And that's when I told him, so the purpose of being a doctor, a nurse, a psychologist, a therapist, or even just a friend, is not to cure your patients. You can't do that. Because they will die eventually, and sometimes the diseases are beyond your ability to cure. But you can always care for them. That's something you can always do. So if you make caring more important than curing, you never need to feel you failed. He said also, you will find, he confirms this over so many years, you will cure so many more patients when you make caring the most important part of your profession. And that's caring, not curing. Caring for yourself, not trying to cure yourself of your imperfections, but caring for yourself. Caring for others, not trying to cure them. You have a partner, parents, children who misbehave. Please care for them. Make that more important than trying to cure them of their imperfections. Care for them first. Then their imperfections, they just disappear. That's the best way.
Yeah, since we're closing to the time limit, I might ask one more last question. So, let's go for this one. How to deal with relationship with careless or difficult people? Should we just let it go for the sake of our own sanity?
Well, if it's relationship with killers. Now, first of all, like any crime, look upon it as like a disease, like a mental disease. So they need to be put in quarantine. Like, you know, you put people with like COVID in quarantine because it can be infectious. It's dangerous to be around such people. But once, you know, the COVID has disappeared, you let them out of quarantine and they can just join society again. You can have wonderful times together. So, and if it's somebody who has done some terrible, terrible things and they're still dangerous, they have to be put in sort of isolation just to protect themselves and protect themselves from others. Then afterwards, there's no such thing, as I said, as a killer, as a murderer. It's just a person who's killed. It's a person who's stolen. A person who's made a mistake. A person who's done a terrorist act. That doesn't make them a terrorist. There's more to them than that. And so, you know, if you have a relationship with someone who's done some terrible things, see if you can notice the beautiful part of them. And that will sort of grow so much that the bad part of them just disappears.
Okay, that last question concludes our Q&A session for today. Thank you once again, Ajahn Brown, for all the beautiful teachings that you have given us for today. Now I would hand the floor back to our host for the night, Quincy.
Hi, thank you, Jesslyn. And thank you, Ajahn. That was a really inspiring talk.
Thank you.
We learned so much today. I personally learned that we need to always look at the bright side for things that we assume to be imperfect, and to love and build good relationships with ourselves, our nearest and dearest, and to all the imperfections in life.
Yay.
So, yeah, I guess next, I would like to take a picture with all of you. So if you can turn on your videos. Awesome. Oh, I can see everyone.
Yay.
Sweet. Okay. So I need to take this screenshot 6 times. So everyone hold your poses. 1, 2, 3. Okay, wait. And then next one. 1, 2, 3. Third screenshot. 1, 2, 3. Okay, fourth screenshot. 1, 2, 3. And then fifth screenshot. 1, 2, 3. Last one. 1, 2, 3. Awesome. All good.
Yay.
Okay. So I think I'd like Donnie to share the screen. Sweet. Right. So for everyone who came here today, thank you very much for attending the event. I hope you guys learned a lot. And if you like it and would like to join some of our other events, do follow our Facebook and Instagram page. CityZen's account is CityZen_BSV. And for Buddhist Union, it's BU Melbourne. Okay, next slide. Right, so here's the donation links again. I hope that you guys can help us to support the NBM building fundraising and robes and other requisite donations. If you ever find any difficulties during the process of sending out the donations, please do email us to treasurer@bsv.net.au. The email will be on the chat box. And yeah, I guess that concludes all for today. Oh, shout out to our ID genius over here. There's Langdon from Buddhist Society of Victoria. Hi, Langdon.
Yay. Well done.
Yep. All good. Okay. Anumodana Karyanamita. Thanks again for everyone for tuning in, especially for those of you who attended both of our events yesterday and today. May everyone always be at peace and stay happy. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.